Hello. Hi. My name is Russell Brand, and I feel nervous about being Conan O'Brien's friend.
Now, why would you say that, Russell? Why would you be nervous at all? We've known each other a little bit over the years. We've always been very chummy, and I like the word chum, so I try to use it as much as possible. What are you nervous about?
Friendship in general. Like, when was the last time you acquired an actual friend?
Oh, well, I don't know that I have one.
You see?
I have lots of people I say, hello, how are you? And on my birthday, they say, thinking of you. But real friend, huh?
I'll wager it's been close to a decade since you've spoken to someone who's not in your pay.
Wow. Oh, my God. You know why people are laughing so hard? Because that has that's an ice dagger of truth. That's what that is right there. That went right through my heart. I did have this thought, Russell, and you have an incredible ability to get right to the heart of the matter. I had a party, like a Christmas party, and I looked around and the room was full. And at one point I realized everyone in this room that I can see right now works for me.
Yeah.
Now, there were other people there who are friends, but I do pay people. Like, Sona, would you be my friend if I weren't paying your mortgage?
No, I would not.
Would you like to think about it more?
You know, you're a lot. You can be a lot. But I would, you know what? I don't want to say a jokey thing. I would actually be your friend because you're cool. You're kind of cool.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was, I don't know. That was uninspiring. You know, that wasn't the rousing speech the Churchillian speech I wanted to hear at this moment. Russell, what do you think? I have the capacity to be a good friend. I know I do. But it would help if I employed you.
Yeah, definitely. I reckon that would certainly make me more enthusiastic. You know, enthusiasm means the energy of God, the presence of God in a project. And I reckon if you were to pay me just a stipend. Not talking about an enormous wage, Conan. I'm not unrealistic. What do I offer? Another narcissist who's slightly different? In ways that aren't necessarily monetizable. I'm not going to increase your audience. I'm not going to do anything for you. I'm not even Andy. What's the point? You're acquiring sidekicks at a rate of knots. Your sidekicks are subdividing. There probably be another sidekick on that panel by the end of this fucking conversation.
You're right. I'm sorry. Russell, please. Please stop yelling at me. It's...
sorry. You know, this is not a criticism of you. I love you.
Well, I love you as well, and I mean that. I've been an admirer of yours for many years, and I will pay you a stipend. I think that's what we call it, stipend. You said stipend? How do you say stipend?
And what I'd like you to do is for a moment reflect on what the language you speak is called and then determine who's correct on that basis.
I speak West Los Angeles Queen's English. Listen, I'm going to tell you that I grew up in, this just comes to mind, but I grew up just outside Boston, and I grew up visiting my grandparents in Worcester and going to Sturbridge and driving through Cambridge and Needham and Framingham. And then later on, as a young lad, I started to read about England. And I honestly thought that you guys took those names from us. I really believed it. And I thought, who are they to be taking our town? I remember voicing that to someone and them correcting me and me feeling ashamed. But anyway, I just grew up with that narcissistic American belief that we created everything. It was we who did it. And then you guys copied us and somehow got hold of a time machine.
I suppose that's the kind of certainty that's required to build an empire.
It wasn't always like that.
No, first they had to come from little towns with strange names like
Smegma,
Spasmodic,
Frog,
and the far-flung Isles of Langerhans.
But who were they?
We were small, angry men with hairy faces and burning feet. We were running away from poverty, intolerance, and the law
army.
And the army.
And we took to them.
And they took to us.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
But we couldn't do it alone.
Now we needed the hope, the faith, the prayers, the fears.
The sweat, the pain, the boils, the tears.
The broken bones.
The broken homes.
The total degradation of...
Who?
You, the little guy.
And across him all we flung one shining steel rail.
Rockefeller. 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 Rockefeller.
Make one shining steel rail. From sea to mighty sea. From coast to mighty coast. From Bangor all the way to mighty
If, like, America had no self-confidence, if America thought, I'm not sure that this is right, how do you, for example, I don't know, fund international wars against your ideological opponents unless there's a sort of certainty that you're right? And I'm not suggesting this is unique to American people or the American nation, because Britain did it for, you know, a good few centuries as well. The assumption of correctness of our perspective, which is one of the things that we're seeing now, this sort of fragmenting of the presumed universal as identity politics is on the rise, rage in politics on the rise, a sense of, well, who are we? What is it to be an American anymore? And why the hell are there so many places called Cambridge?
Okay, well, listen, I'm going to say two things, Russell. First, by the way, we are, Russell, I wanted to make this very clear. Russell is in England right now.
So after the Second World War, the whole, you know, world was going, come on, Europe, give these countries back. Come on, you know, we've had a bloody war. Let's give them back. Britain, what? What's that behind your back? Oh, it's India and a number of other countries. Give them back. Oh, all right, there's that one. Falkland Islands. Oh, we need the Falkland Islands for strategic sheep purposes. Yeah. And then it was a case of no empire, no longer. But in America, it was different. The Founding Fathers landed in 16... They set off from Plymouth and landed in Plymouth. How lucky is that? This is Plymouth. We've just come from Plymouth. We've gone round the circle. Lads, back on the bus. They finally got there, said, ah, this is where our God has brought us to. We can practice our religion here. We can raise a family. There's nobody here. Excuse me? There's nobody here. Yes, a land empty of human existence. Look at these guys. What's all this, please? No, we don't want any of your food, thank you very much. Just put some clothes on. Meanwhile, that winter, excuse me, do you have any food? I love all this, lovely idea. Yes, I'm sorry, we're a bit brusque when we first arrived. We didn't realize you owned the entire country. But you have no system of ownership. Interesting. Maybe that can come in useful later. Food, thank you very much, very nice. Yes, there's more of us coming, but we all keep our promises. So the American government lied to the Native Americans for many, many years. And then President Clinton lied about a relationship. And everyone was surprised. A little naive, I feel.
And we like to do these interviews in the same room. But because of the international pandemic.
What?
I'll tell you more. We are doing this over a Zoom line, and I'm watching Russell as he drinks probably the largest bottle of water I've seen in the last easy 20 years. But I'm going to say two things, Russell. First, I'm going to say this: the moment I sense even the slightest atom of anti-American sentiment, this interview is over. And because I won't have that, not on this show. This show is very pro-American, jingoistic. And second of all, I agree with everything you just said. I think on a slightly serious note, I think blind certainty has probably driven most of mankind. I'm not saying for the better, but just in a direction. And I do believe that you cannot, if America in 1800, if most Americans had said, yeah, I don't know. I mean, who are we to be doing what we're doing? We'd still be huddled along the Eastern shoreline. But it was the certainty that we deserved this continent and that anybody in our way should die that made everything happen and led to the McDonald's arch.
My fellow Redskins, speaking for the great white father in Washington and all the American people, let me say we respect you, savages, for your native ability to instantly adapt and survive in whatever godforsaken wilderness we move you to. Out there. Sign here.
They did it! Yeah!
No reason to complain. It's not so bad out there. We still have our people and our ceremonies and the sun, moon, and stars and the sand and the black stuff coming out of the ground.
Black stuff coming out of the ground?
Civilization! Oh!
So I don't know if that's a good thing. I think it's probably a bad thing, but it's what happened. And as you said, you guys did it before us, and the French did it. The Romans did it. Everybody did it. It's the imperative. I am certain. I am certain.
Yeah, I think that the certainty begins even before the verb in the sentence. It begins with the I. What is this perspective from which we observe things, that to which we immediately apply a lens of preferences? I like this, I dislike that. What is this I? Man, I've been spending a lot of time on my own, Conan.
I know, I could tell. I could tell you immediately have gone to... You know, most people spend, at least on my podcast, spend at least the first 15, 20 minutes talking about, you know, what kind of jeans they prefer or their diet or something about their career. You, within seconds, went to what is I? Which I admire. That's something I admire.
What is receiving the senses? What is behind the lens, Conan? I mean, what's happened is, I think, I've not required as much therapy because, you know, I'm not going out as much, so I'm not talking to people. If I'm not talking to people, I don't require as much therapy. I don't require as many support groups. But what's happened is I've drifted into this sort of low-level, lethargic state of constant reflection and dismantling, you know, meditate, like through meditation. The only thing that keeps me normal is the fact I've got two young daughters, and yep. there's no room there for any of this existential inquiry. Simply wipe up the urine. That's all that's required.
That happens again later in life, Russell. I'm just telling you. I'm a bit older than you, and I'm telling you that there's another phase of where did this urine come from? But we'll get into that later. You know, I had the experience of a profound experience of when my first child was born. I have two children. They're a bit older than your children. My children are in their mid-60s. My daughter, when she was born, my first child, I remembered she was born and I was right there and helped take the baby out of my wife and cut the umbilical cord, much more involved than I wanted to be. I wanted to be watching it all on Skype from a 5-star hotel hundreds of miles away. But what happened was I received this baby, and my immediate thought was, oh, I don't matter anymore. And I thought that in a positive way. Like, that was the time that I felt this thing lifting of, I mean, clearly I've been on a journey since a youth to, I sometimes walk around our offices and it's just filled with fan artwork and giant posters that say Conan and Conan and Conan and Conan, and the show's called Conan, and I make all my employees brand Conan onto their ass. So I've been driven by this something, and then it really did bring me a long way towards, oh, I don't matter, is when my children were born. That helped a lot.
Yeah, it's one of the things I'm thinking about a lot at the moment during my mental breakdown is the appearance of the sacred in the ordinary. And I suppose what the way that many of us experience that is through the birth of our children, the disruption of every day. But even this interruption that we're globally experiencing is an opportunity to reflect on what we assume is normal. Like, now that going to a supermarket, say, has become this bizarre, fantastical experience, this sort of odd, balkanized trip to the supermarket 2 meters apart, it's made me realize supermarkets are always strange. All of civilization is strange. We're living amidst so many strange assumptions. It's so seldom now in the fragmenting times that I've already referenced that there is a kind of certainty. The certainty of knowing that you love a child, the recognition in that moment of, oh yeah, I don't really matter. And for that to feel like a positive thing, because I imagine you've grappled with the idea of not mattering quite a lot. I mean, how else?
How dare you? How dare you, sir?
No, come on.
How dare you? How dare you, sir? How dare you?
How can you be? Oh, surely. Oh, you must.
Oh, I wish I was wearing a monocle right now so it could fall out. Shock, registering surprise. I think we have this in common. I don't understand anybody who could possibly be in comedy who didn't have a very anxious and somewhat unsettled childhood. And I know that that's a cliche, but it's a cliche, I think, because it's true. I spent a lot of my childhood thinking I don't have a personality. I don't think I'm really good at anything. I'm certainly not picked first or even in the middle. I'm towards one of the last people picked when they want to play a sport. And I think that because I went through that stage, that, I don't know, that was some sort of chemical thing began that I had to figure out who I was. And then, of course, that started working so furiously at an early age that now I live in I'm like a Batman villain. I live in a lair, and everything, I'm just surrounded by my name in large type.
Hemlock Stones pursues the electrician all the way back to the United States, to the acme of power, Mr. Acme, Jonas Acme and his company. I think they're the ones who make all of those things that Wile E. Coyote tries to use. That's the same Acme, the giant Acme company. They made a terrible beer called Acme beer. They were into everything, Jonas was.
Did you look at the mouth of that gift horse?
Senator Dudley, have you met Boyle M. Owl, president of the Bowel Oil Company?
How do you do?
How do you do what?
That's a great joke. Say, didn't we spend a weekend at Ted Klamstruck's Nig Island Retreat?
That's right. It's with Prick and Pat Orr.
The parents are. Remember the brush was there, the writer's wife?
The
that was the weekend we played Hide the Housekeeper.
Right, an old body lost.
Yeah, she's still lost. Well, gentlemen, ladies, fellow rich people. I see that both of Mickey's hands are pointing to 12. That means... Oh, shut up, Dud. I see that it's now 6 a.m. in Goonrat, where the gumboat Matilda Briggs, under my secret orders, is now docking with a holdful of Dudley Pignuts from the Senator's own Dudley Rubber Company.
which I own.
You know, those natives have to have a constant supply of pig nuts or they go out of their
heads.
Yes,
yes. Well, you see, this move diverts the world's supply of genuine pig nut oil to the Chicago breweries of our good friend here, Boyle M.O., who I own.
I'm proud to be an owned man.
Yes, 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 yes. And with that much oil beer in the American working man, he'll be more than glad to turn out the lamps of the world.
You carry the big whip.
Wick. That's a wick. The Acme Whip Wick.
Why, that little gadget will blacken peasants' houses throughout the globe.
And where there's smoke, there's work. Yes, 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 yes.
And everybody's working on the Conan Project. And you're like, oh, Jesus. So this, and I think you had a little bit of a similar feeling in childhood. You were not always the Russell Brand we see.
No, I was a right anxious, nervous, ferrety little boy, twitchy little creature.
Would you gnaw through wiring? Is that something you would do often, is gnaw through wiring?
Some weird electrician on the wire, repairs or something, see?
The boss, I know who that is. Thanks, Hal.
Nod wires, no doubt.
Nod who?
Oh, just an ingenue I know.
Joe, you're wired.
If I got access to wiring, my incisors were straight in it. Otherwise, the damn things, they keep on growing. They keep on burrowing down little ivory little spears. The amount of calcium I'm going for.
Yes, to live, a rat must chew.
So must we all. We eat or we die, eh?
I did not say eat. I said chew.
Gesundheit.
Gesundheit. Of course. Gesundheit, Dankeschön, the chip's Prussian captain. Frigate.
Oh, really, Stones?
Frigate Matilda, plying her illicit trade in rubber goods and spiders up and down the Mokujava Strait from Singapore to Sinatra. Frankly, Flotsam, it's all beginning to make sense.
Let's turn sense to pounds, old man. Tell me the whole bizarre story.
Well, yes, I suppose I can tell you, but the public must never know.
Oh, I'll just write that down.
It was long before I met you, Doctor.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You went to the Met.
You were in Afghanistan.
I was wearing Stanley's Afghan.
I was playing the Outer Islands with a small theatrical company. We were holed up in a rat-tan festooned pension in Goonrot.
Really? Oh, rat-infested tension in Goonrot.
You see, Clarkson, if they don't chew, their teeth grow through their brains.
How very incisive.
Yeah. So you were an anxious kid.
Yeah, very much. And I was trying to... I want to know when you felt that anxiety abate. The first time listen, this is pretty telling, like, I suppose. The first times I felt aligned, connected, or like I was good at something, first was being in a school play and people laughing and thinking, oh my God, I'm good at something. And then just a few years later, on the streets of Patpong, Thailand, when some sex workers left their post, Conan, to pursue me at 16 down the street, and my dad looked approvingly at his son.
Really? Let's examine that moment. They just liked the cut of your jib. They saw you walking down the street and they said, well, that's a fine-looking young lad.
They left their posts. A sex worker must never leave their post. Not on in the Patpong district. Those posts are hard won. Those pitches. But no.
Hi, Slim. Say, why don't you get in?
Wow. Really? Lips, shapely hips when she walked across the street. I'll bet you all the cats flipped. What was her game? Strip poker and everything wild? That reminded me of strip poker. The Detroit hitman. He warned me that Johnny Fresno liked his women rough, but this one was making my hard part soft. Her heavily rouged nipples thrust like highball glasses through a persimmon sweater that looked like a heavyweight watermelon bout. Her waist was unusually small and laced tight with string cheese. There's my first clue, I thought. String cheese, Fresno, Armenians. You see, it all started to add up at the counter, but those twin bulges wouldn't let me check out so soon.
Say, Lips, you better stop talking to yourself and get in, or maybe we'll see if your rod is any match for this one. No!
It wasn't. I was staring down the barrel of three .45s, and then one in the middle looked hungry.
What a ride!
I got in slowly like a hipster at a funeral, and she burned some rubber. Her breasts swelled as she put the keys to the gears.
They came after me, and I remember feeling terribly fulfilled by the whole experience. Not carnally, or even concupiscently.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Just fantastic.
Thank you so much. That's the approval I live for. In fact, I would argue that all addictive behaviours or habitual behaviours, and I reckon you're a workaholic, are a sort of personal strategy for dealing with feelings of inadequacy and worthlessness. And it's no coincidence that I perhaps went on to act out a lot sexually, you know, I think, given that original impulse, not to mention certain obvious other drives. Should we call them? Let's just call them drive scones.
Yes. We'll leave that. I've never been pursued by sex workers at any age. And I've never had them leave their posts for me.
Stay in their station, do they?
Yes, the sex workers.
You go by, they remain at their station.
Here's what I think, Russell. I think I'm equally attractive as you. I just think that I encounter sex workers that take their profession more seriously and will not leave their post. I think they are just as enraptured by me as those sex workers were by you, but the sex workers that see me they take their sacred oath more seriously.
The Hippocratic oath of sex work of do no wrong and do not leave your post is absolutely vital.
The last time I was in Vegas, the strip was jammed with families and little kids. And everywhere I looked, there were ads for threesomes, S&Ms, M&Ms, you name it.
Well, don't be so quick to condemn, my friend. Every one of those hookers is somebody's daughter.
Yeah, it brings a whole new meaning to family fun, though, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Besides, as they say, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Unless you bring home a dose of the clap.
I did a gig in, it was many years ago, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I did a gig in Las Vegas, and I'm walking down the strip, and this guy's saying, two girls, $100. And I said, I turned to him, and I looked at him, nobody makes eye contact with these guys, you know. I said, what's the other girl for? Does she take notes? And the guy looks at me for a second, blinks, and says, two girls, $100. I mean, that's just so degrading.
Take notes. That's an interesting idea.
I don't know.
Maybe the other girl is studying for her, you know, sociology.
They're all studying, you know, to go to college. I'm not a whore. I'm not on the pole. I'm just earning enough money to go to business school so I can open another Bunny Mustang Ranch somewhere and know what I'm doing.
Yeah, get that MBA.
These sex workers that you've been parading past, I'm troubled. they're a higher quality, clearly. And I see us as, you and I are identical, give or take a few drops of pigment.
Yes. You have a nice, I envy you. You have that that jet black hair. And I know that you can tan up very nicely. You have that olive skinned hue. I am a pudding, a white rice pudding that has just started to turn, has just started to go bad.
I think you're beautiful, and you look like those when they do like that opera in Japan where they have lovely white faces.
You're talking about kabuki, yes, kabuki. Yes.
I'd say that you're sort of Irish kabuki. Celtic kabuki with Conan. Yes. Now, there's an item. I'm already paying off my stipend. Celtic kabuki with Conan.
I have seen the kabuki.
Ant!
I have met Mr. Yamada.
Wet!
Sometimes I go to Taiwan.
Wet!
Sometimes I see kabuki plays.
With ants!
Sometimes I meet with Mr. Yamada.
Get your aunt, Mr. Yamada.
Tomorrow I can go to Sapporo. Next year I can go to Taiwan.
I want a Taiwan on.
I can always
get under this eagle, baby.
Japanese.
Keep you out of the rain.
Cooking.
Yes. See, this is
and Sona. For God's sake, give it a bit of femininity.
Yes. Stipend. You'll get your stipend. You'll get your tuppence. You'll get your farthing. I'll buy you that goose in the window on Christmas Day. Today's Christmas Day. I can't help it, and I'm going to hell. I think that I remember my memories of people laughing or finding something I did funny are so crystal clear, and I've forgotten huge chunks of my life, you know, not because of drug use or anything like that, just because they've just faded out into the background. But I remember clearly being in the schoolyard, and I had found a cane, and I was doing some bits with it, some shtick, and I crossed one leg over the other, knocking the cane out accidentally, a la Chaplin, and fell over, and a bunch of kids laughed. That is in 3D high def in my mind, and I can't remember my wedding day. So this is the sadness of the whole thing. But I remember very clearly thinking, oh, that's the way through. That's how I'll make it.
Yeah, and to our earlier point about certainty, this moment that you're describing, I think, has been characterized as like sometimes as epiphany or connection or meeting the daemon or the spirit or the djinn, just in some moment recognizing this is who I am, this is what I'm about. I'm not just a featureless Celtic kabuki fella. I am a man with purpose and an ability to carry off an admittedly plagiarized physical piece of comedy.
Yes, well, put from one of the greats, Charlie Chaplin, so I'll do that. Yeah, it's funny because I have a very vivid memory of the first time I met you. You were becoming a very talked about comedian, and you came on my late night show in New York, and I had seen clips of you performing, and I thought, well, he's very funny and he's very different. And I went backstage just before you came out to say hello, and you were pacing like a lion in a cage. You were pacing, and you know, some comedians have almost a eerie detachment, and you were worked up into a state, and you were pacing, and you came out and you perched on the furniture, and you were so in the moment, and it was hilarious. It was really funny and exciting. But I remember thinking, this guy approaches this in this life or death way that I find compelling and that I like, and I prefer this to the kind of casual guy puts out his cigarette, walks out there, does his thing. I don't know if you have, if that was the way you always were backstage, but I remembered that moment very clearly.
Even to live in the memory of a man like you is a great honor. I nearly wept at your recollection there, just to feel that revivified. I do remember that, and it was a real big deal to go on your show and to come over to, like, to be coming to your country and to sort of, I remember that feeling of burgeoning fame, that feeling of transcendence. What I didn't know then and do know now, but I'm sort of struggling to accept, is that the kind of architecture and accolades of fame mimic something that is real, a kind of self-actualization, a self-realization, a kind of connection. Like you, with your story with your cane when you was a kid, I felt very connected to comedy. It's felt like something that's always been there for me, always been real for me, and has made being who I am something bearable, and like something that, you know, it's been hard. I've felt, you know, like amidst the narcissism and the self-aggrandizing shtick, I've been, you know, like had a lot of mental health issues and drug issues, which I've obviously banged on about and metastasized into all sorts of, frankly, money. But like,
but it's been lucrative. Russell, all of us. I mean, first of all, you shouldn't feel bad about that. You have made your pain lucrative. You have, and that is the essence of what we do.
I've had some very lucrative mental illnesses over the years.
I've mentioned this before, Russell, but my father, who is a very smart guy and a scientist, I think a few years into my late night show, and this is after years and years of him seeing me work this stuff out, he said to me, and he wasn't making a joke, he just said, I see, you're making your living off of something that should probably be treated. And he wasn't being funny. He was, I mean, people think, oh, your dad's funny. No, he wasn't being funny. He was giving a very frank analysis of what this was. And I know that for you, you've been through, like, you've been very frank about all the things that you've been through, which I think you know, you have a choice that you can make at some point, which is clearly there are people in our business that keep, they have these issues and they just keep throwing blankets and pillows on top of it, just trying to stifle it. And that's addiction, that's outlandish, insane behavior, or else you grapple with it and you try and see, does this lead to anything else? It's sad, but the sentence I was going to say, does this lead to more funny stuff? When I should have said, does this lead to peace and inner calm? But instead, I was really about to say, hey, let's examine this pain, because maybe there's more funny stuff there, which is a sad thing to say.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? This pursuit of content, the pursuit of more material, more jokes. I love it, and it can get a little bit frenetic and frenzied, the pursuit of that. But I feel that... you know that phrase Buddha nature, like that everyone has a Buddha nature. Don't you sometimes when you meet people think, I wonder how they'd be as a priest or a rabbi or an imam or whatever the thing they're into is. I sometimes sense it about people that there's a version of them that if they were to strip back the appurtenances of their cultural identity would radiate out. And I think in that moment of pacing around backstage trying to find who I was as a inverted commas performer, I got close to, oh, this is who you are, essentially. The challenge, I think, comes as a result of us living in a fully immersive fundamentalist ideological system that can never, and it makes sense this, be declared as such because it's horizonless. You can never identify capitalist consumerism as a kind of extremist ideology in the same way that you would be able to identify communism or an extremist religious ideology, because it's everywhere. It's all encompassing. Everything you do becomes monetizable. Like, and I, as a person that was really famous for a little bit, it was weird to be caught in that tundra, in that tunnel, in that, you know, because, and I still sometimes want it. I still sometimes think, wow, you should be a bit more famous, actually. You should be being in more films, on some bigger posters and stuff. And then I remember it actually made me feel physically sick and ill the whole time. But, I don't know what to do with these drives anymore, man.
Yeah, but that's worth mining right now because, I don't think it's much different. It's probably no different in England, but I'll tell you, as you know, here in the United States, everybody's obsessed with the concept of fame. Everybody's, I've met so many people over the years that have said, I want to do what you do, or I want to be famous. We've all had the feeling of, should I need more of this? Where am I in relationship to other people? And the one thing that I almost feel is like my duty as a human being is to try and tell as many people as I can that there's plenty of nice things about my life that I really like, but fame in and of itself is a clear broth with absolutely no nutrition. There's no nutrition in it. There's no protein. There's no carbohydrates. There's no amino acids. There's nothing.
Tired of something different? Think you've eaten it all? Well, you're wrong again. Until you've tasted Real Food Brand reconstituted artificial food with just a hint of taste. Real Food Brand is so good, you can't tell it from the real thing. Packed in plastic to keep it clean, Real Food comes in three USDA approved flavors. Spicy wool, imitation chicken fricassee, and desert-tested salt.
And in two convenient textures, bland, and for the youngsters, new now nitty-gritty bland. Buy some today. You'll never forget you did.
And when people get addicted to that, there's a reason why a lot of them die when they're 45, because it doesn't go anywhere. It feels stupid. There's small little nice things of, oh, I think I got a table in a restaurant faster than I would have were I not a recognizable kabuki Irishman. But no, other than that, I think it's very hard to get people to understand that. And I've met so many people who've said, oh, I'm interested in doing what you're doing. And to me, that should mean that you're interested in making people laugh. You're interested in making stuff. I say it's as simple as I like to make stuff. And then there's this byproduct of making stuff, and some of it's nice and some of it's not so nice. But when people get just obsessed with, no, I just want everyone to know who I am. I think, well, there's a lot of pain that that goes with that drive, and a lot of dissatisfaction, and you can never fill that hole.
It's hardly surprising that so many people have it, given its ubiquity. And even your description of fame as a broth, I would query. I think it's completely, I would say it's more like a synthetic saliva, a foaming synthetic saliva made outside of the body.
Okay. Well, why can't we agree that, yes, mine is a nutritionless broth, yours is a foaming saliva made outside the body. Why can't we say that it's a saliva made outside the body consisting of a nutritionless broth? Why can't we agree? Why am I fighting with you? Why is my ego now asserting itself that I can't be wrong about the broth and that you have to give me some credence on the broth?
If you and I can't find some peace over this broth stroke synthetic saliva hydra that we're making right now with our minds, then what hope is there in the Middle East? What hope is there in fragmented America? What hope is there in post-Brexit Britain? What hope is there that this coronavirus will lead to some kind of global awakening where we recognize we're living in synthetic systems, much like that synthetic saliva, which could never be compared to a broth, in my view.
Damn you! Damn you, you won that round. All right. I yield the floor. It is more, from now on, I will tell people it's a synthetic saliva made outside the body. And clearly that's why you're drinking so much water during this interview, is to create more of this synthetic saliva. I have a pot of flavorless broth brewing in the corner, which you can't see. But the important thing is we've both found that, and here's the problem, is that these realizations, I'm thinking about anyone listening right now saying, yeah, duh. We've all heard before that the real things are the smile of a child and an apple blossom on a nice day. And, you know, okay. The thing is, those things are true. And there are these moments of deep satisfaction. And the problem is that when you try to enunciate that, when you try to clarify that, you run the risk of people saying, yeah, no, I've heard that. I've seen that on posters. And I think, I know, but it's a cliche because it's true.